watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
Tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Benner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Capitalism's next economic crisis is upon us. And the news last week was full of discussions of the fall of the stock market, the weakness of the dollar, the need for fiscal stimulus, and so on. Capitalism in its few hundred years of existence has undergone continual cycles of crisis, recession, depression, inflation, stagflation. These crises each have some nominal catalyst, in this case, the so-called subprime problem. But these crises are caused by the structural flaws in capitalism and markets. At the rotten heart of it all is banking, which is again at the eye of the storm. In previous shows, you've heard how money is credit created out of thin air through the issuance of loans by banks. These loans must be paid back with interest, which is why people who really need money don't get loans. They can't pay them back. And thus why about a third of the world's population, about 2 billion people, are literally starving. It's not for lack of food, it's for lack of money. They don't have access to money to buy food others have produced, or access to land to grow their own, while elsewhere surplus food is thrown away each day. Capitalism is not about meeting needs, it's about making profits, and doing this through selling and buying. Thus, it only addresses the needs of those who have the financial means to buy. This poses a problem for capitalism and the stock market. The compounding of interest at the heart of the system requires that enterprises grow just to stay even and grow increasingly to satisfy their stockholders' wish for increased profits. Thus, these capitalist enterprises must constantly increase their customer base. The weakness of an economic order that requires an increasing spiral of buying and selling should be obvious, but for some reason it is not. At some point, you run out of people to buy what you are selling. Those that can afford to buy have already bought. Those that haven't bought because they can't afford to buy, and are of no use from the capitalist perspective. This is where the so-called subprime issue comes in. Banks are institutions that sell loans. That's how they make profits. As they only make loans to people who already have money or some form of valuable collateral, at some point they can't increase their sales. Capitalists, through outsourcing production, have beggared their customers. If their customers actually began to live within their new means, the economy begins to collapse, to contract. That's what's now happening. Credit is drying up because so many of the borrowers are so maxed out they can't take on more debt and must decrease consumption. Some of them cannot even pay back what they owned. This leads to decreasing sales and declining profits and a downward spiral that picks up speed. This cycle repeats endlessly in capitalism, which is why I say this system is dysfunctional and absurd. When I was a child and heard about the Great Depression, I was baffled. I couldn't understand why just because something called the stock market collapsed, people should be hungry and homeless. After all, the homes had not collapsed. The wheat in the fields had not collapsed. The apples on the trees and so on had not collapsed. But these things were locked away behind the gate of money. Money is defined in economics as a medium of exchange, a thing which facilitates exchange. I would argue that what it is a gatekeeper separating humans from what they need, that it results in overproduction and useless production, overconsumption in some places and unmet needs in others. It's lauded as a marvelous invention. I think it's one of our biggest evolutionary mistakes and has now brought us to the doorstep of extinction because it's uneconomical not to eliminate waste and pollution. In the conventional political discourse, capitalism is often equated with democracy in societies such as ours. I want to argue that what our society actually is a tyranny of money. We'll pursue a deeper understanding of this on the program this week. Let's begin with a bit of humor from British television, from a pair of comedians called the Two Johns. They're sitting on a stage, two middle-aged gray-haired men in suits, the banker and the TV talk show host, discussing the financial markets.
So, George Parr, you are an investment banker.
I am, yes.
Yes. And as such, you have your fingers right on the pulse of the financial market.
Yeah, very much so, yes.
And during the summer, there's been a great deal of turbulence and volatility
in the market. Yes. Yes, tremendous. Yes, tremendous.
Yes, and what has caused that?
Well, you have to remember two things about the markets. One is that they are made up of very sharp and sophisticated people. Mm. And the second thing you have to remember is that the financial markets, to use the common phrase, are driven by sentiment.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? Well, things, let's say, are just going along as normal in the market. And then, suddenly, out of the blue, one of these very sharp and sophisticated people says, "My God, something awful's going to happen! We've lost everything! Oh, my God, what are we going to do? What are we going to do?
Shall I jump out of the window?
Shall I jump out of the window? Exactly. Let's all jump out of the window.
Sell!
We've lost it.
Sell! Yes.
Precisely.
Yes.
Precisely. And then a few days later, this same sophisticated person says, "You know, I think things are going rather well." And everybody says, "Yes, I agree with you. I think we're rich. We're rich.
Yes. Rich. Yes. Bye, bye, bye.
Bye, bye, bye. Yes.
Yes,
and that's what we call market sentiment.
yes. Surely we are exaggerating just a bit, aren't
we? Well, I don't know. I mean, in August, in the middle of August this year, when the market absolutely plunged in London, a well-known city firm, State Street Global Markets, mm-hmm. Issued a statement in which it said, and I quote, "Market participants don't know whether to buy on the rumour and sell on the news, do the opposite, do both, or do neither, depending on which way the wind is blowing," unquote.
Yes, and this is the kind of rigorous analysis that companies
yes.
will pay huge salaries
huge,
for.
Yes, exactly.
It?
And a few days later, when the market had gone up a little bit, the senior equities advisor on ABM, Ambro Morgan, said, and I quote, "We're back to happy days again."
Well, no price is too high
for that,
for that kind of mature wisdom,
certainly
is it?
Not. This sort of people are paid millions of pounds in bonuses.
Yes, of course. During this summer, there have been actual causes behind the volatility in the markets,
yes,
haven't there? I mean, specifically and
especially
in America, granting vast numbers of mortgages to people who can't afford them on properties which are diminishing in value.
Yes, it's a so-called subprime situation, yes.
The subprime market. Yes. How does that work, in fact?
Well, imagine, if you can, say, an unemployed black man sitting on a crumbling porch somewhere in Alabama in his string vest, and a chap comes along and said, "Would you like to buy this house before it falls down? And why don't you let me lend you the money?"
And is this chap who says this, is he a banker?
Oh, no. He's a mortgage salesman. His income depends entirely on the number of mortgages that he can arrange.
So his judgment to arrange mortgages is completely objective?
Completely objective, yes. Absolutely.
It would.
Yes. Yes.
And what happens next?
Well, then this debt, this mortgage, is taken, bought by a bank and packaged together on Wall Street with a lot of other similar debts.
Without going into much detail about what is actually...
Without going into any detail. No, it's far too boring. And so this is put into a package of debt. And then it's moved on to Wall Street. And this is extraordinary what happens then. That somehow this package of dodgy debts stops being a package of dodgy debts and starts being what we call a structured investment vehicle.
SIV?
An SIV, exactly, yes.
Yes, I see. And then someone like you comes along and buys it.
I buy it, yes. And yes. Then I will ring up, I don't know, somebody in Tokyo and say, look, I've got this package, do you want to buy it?
Mm-hmm.
And they say, what's in it? I say, I haven't got the faintest idea. And they say, how much do you want for it? And I say, $100 million. And then they say, fine, that's it. And that's the market.
And presumably, this package, I mean, that kind of thing can happen several times
package. Possibly, yes.
And every time it does, of course, then you or someone like you will get a fee and a markup.
And a profit.
And so
well, if I'm expected to do it for nothing, it's hard work, maybe.
In view of the fact that in these packages is a lot of dodgy debt, what is it about it that attracts the financial, risk takers?
Yes, well, because these hedge funds, as they're called, which specialise in these debts, they all have very good names.
You mean they're responsible companies?
No, I don't know. It's nothing to do with their reputation. They have actually very, very good names. The names they think up for them are very good. I'll give you an example. there's a very well-known American Wall Street firm called Bear Stearns who have two of these hedge funds which specialize in these mortgage debts. And they lost so much money, lost so much of its value, that Bear Stearns announced that they would have to put in $3.2 billion into one of the funds to try and keep it afloat.
$3.2 billion,
yes. And even then, they said the investors couldn't get any money out of it and they were going to let the other fund go. But one of these funds was called the High Grade Structured Credit Strategies Fund, and the other was called the High Grade Structured Credit Enhanced Leverage Fund.
Well, that sounds very good.
But that's good, isn't it?
Yes. Sounds very trustworthy.
Actually, this is the magic of the market. What started off as lending a few thousand dollars to an unemployed black man in a string vest has become a high-grade structured credit enhanced leverage fund.
I like the sound of it.
It is good. Well, it sounds very trustworthy. I mean, it's got good words in it. It's got words like high.
High is good.
High is good.
Yes.
Better than low, anyway, isn't
it? Yes, absolutely.
And structured is another good word.
Very good.
Enhanced.
I love enhanced.
Enhanced is very
I mean, I'd buy anything if it said enhanced.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes.
It might have been different if it said the unemployed black man in the string vest fund, but
yes, because then alarm bells might
start to ring.
But despite these very plausible names, surely the reality is that the people that lent all this money have been incredibly stupid.
Oh, no. The reality is that what was stupid is that at some point somebody asked how much money these houses were actually worth.
That's stupid.
If they hadn't bothered to ask that question, then everything would have gone on as perfectly normal. But unfortunately, they did.
I see, but now, you see, people are saying the crisis is likely to turn into a financial meltdown. I mean, can that be avoided?
It can be avoided, provided that governments and central banks give us, the financial speculators, back the money that we've lost.
But isn't that rewarding greed and stupidity?
No. It's rewarding what the Prime Minister Gordon Brown called the ingenuity of the markets. That is.
You see, and
we don't want this money to spend on ourselves. We want this money just to go into the market so that we can carry on borrowing and lending money as if nothing had happened without thinking too much about it.
Yes, but if the worst came to the worst and you didn't get this money, what then?
Well, then there'd be another market crash, and then I would say to you what people like me always say, that it's not us that will suffer, it's your pension fund.
Thank you very much, George Parr.
A pleasure.
That was the British comedy team, the Two Johns. I'm sorry about the racist tone of that piece, but it's appropriate because so many of the people caught in the subprime scheme are low-income people of color, and also because many financial commentators on the business shows are busy laying the blame for the collapse of the banking system on the low-income borrowers who lied about their income. As usual, the role of victim and victimizer are spun 180 degrees. Next, I'd like to read you an article that makes clear the nature and depth of the situation that is euphemistically referred to as the subprime crisis. The series is called The Financial Tsunami, and the author is F. William Engdahl. It was published on his site, oilgeopolitics.net. Engdahl is also author of a new book, Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, that was released last November. He also authored A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics from Pluto Press. The article I'm going to read you, The Financial Tsunami, is to be a three-part series. The third part is not yet released. So I'm going to begin with part one, which was published at the end of November, then read you part two, just released on January 18th. Part one of The Financial Tsunami is subtitled Deutsche Bank's Painful Lesson. Engdahl wrote, and this was in the end of November, the time frame is important, "Even experienced banker friends tell me that they think the worst of the U.S. banking troubles are over and that things are slowly getting back to normal. What is lacking in their rosy optimism is the realization of the scale of the ongoing deterioration in credit markets globally, centered in the American asset-backed securities market, and especially in the market for CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, and CMOs, collateralized mortgage obligations." By now, every serious reader has heard the term. It's a crisis in subprime U.S. home mortgage debt. What almost no one I know understands is that the subprime problem is but the tip of a colossal iceberg that is in a slow meltdown. I offer one recent example to illustrate my point that the financial tsunami is only beginning. Deutsche Bank got a hard shock a few days ago when a judge in the state of Ohio in the USA made a ruling that the bank had no legal right to foreclose on 14 homes whose owners had failed to keep current in their monthly mortgage payments. Now, this might sound like small beer for Deutsche Bank, one of the world's largest banks with over $1.1 trillion in assets worldwide. As Hilmar Koper used to say, peanuts. It's not at all peanuts, however, for the Anglo-Saxon banking world and its European allies like Deutsche Bank, BNP Paribas, Barclays Bank, HSBC, or others. Why? A U.S. federal judge, C.A. Boyko, in federal district court in Cleveland, Ohio, ruled to dismiss a claim by Deutsche Bank National Trust Company, DB's U.S. subsidiary, was seeking to take possession of 14 homes from Cleveland residents living in them in order to claim the assets. Here comes the hair in the soup. The judge asked DB to show documents proving legal title to the 14 homes. DB could not. All DB attorneys could show was a document showing only, quote, an intent to convey the rights in the mortgages, close quote. They could not produce the actual mortgage, the heart of Western property rights since the Magna Carta, if not longer. Again, why could Deutsche Bank not show the 14 mortgages on the 14 homes? Because they live in the new exotic world of global securitization, where banks like DB or Citigroup buy tens of thousands of mortgages from small local lending banks and bundle them into jumbo new securities, which are then rated by Moody's or Standard & Poor's or Fitch and sell them as bonds to pension funds or other banks or private investors who naively believed they were buying bonds rated AAA, the highest, and never realized that their bundle of, say, 1,000 different home mortgages contained maybe 20% or 200 mortgages rated, quote, subprime, i.e., of dubious credit quality. Indeed, the profits being earned in the past 7 years by the world's largest financial players, from Goldman Sachs to Morgan Stanley to HSBC, Chase, and yes, Deutsche Bank, were so staggering, few bothered to open the risk models used by the professionals who bundled the mortgages. Certainly not the big three rating companies, who had a criminal conflict of interest in giving top debt ratings. That changed abruptly last August, and since then, the major banks have issued one after another report of disastrous, quote, subprime losses. The Ohio ruling that dismissed DB's claim to foreclosure and take back the 14 homes for non-payment is far more than bad luck for the bank of Joseph Ackerman. It is an earth-shaking precedent for all banks holding what they had thought were collateral in form of real estate property. How this? Because of the complex structure of asset-backed securities and the widely dispersed ownership of mortgage securities, not actual mortgages, but the securities based on same, no one is yet able to identify who precisely holds the physical mortgage document. Oops! A tiny legal detail our Wall Street rocket scientist derivative experts ignored when they were bundling and issuing hundreds of billions of dollars worth of CMOs in the past 6 or 7 years. As of January 2007, some $6.5 trillion of securitized mortgage debt was outstanding in the United States. That's a lot by any measure. In the Ohio case, Deutsche Bank is acting as the trustee for securitization pools or groups of disparate investors who may reside anywhere. But the trustee never got the legal document known as the mortgage. Judge Boyko ordered DB to prove that they were the owners of the mortgages or notes, and they could not. DB could only argue that the banks had foreclosed on such cases for years without challenge. The judge then declared that the banks seemed to adopt the attitude that since they have been doing this for so long unchallenged, this practice equates with legal compliance. Finally put to the test, the judge concluded, their weak legal arguments compel the court to stop them at the gate, close quote. Deutsche Bank has refused comment. What next? As news of this legal precedent spreads across the USA like a California brush fire, hundreds of thousands of struggling homeowners who took the bait in times of historically low interest rates to buy a home with often no money paid down and the first 2 years with extremely low interest rates in what were known as interest-only adjustable rate mortgages, ARMs, now face exploding mortgage monthly payments at just the point the U.S. economy is sinking into severe recession. The author notes that he regrets the plethora of abbreviations used here, but it is the fault of Wall Street bankers, not this author. The peak period of the U.S. real estate bubble began in about 2002, when Alan Greenspan began the most aggressive series of rate cuts in Federal Reserve history, which was 2005 to 2006. Greenspan's intent, as he admitted at the time, was to replace the dot-com internet stock bubble with a real estate home investment and lending bubble. He argued that was the only way to keep the U.S. economy from deep recession. In retrospect, a recession in 2002 would have been far milder and less damaging than what we now face. Of course, Greenspan has since safely retired, written his memoirs, and handed the control and blame of the mess over to a young ex-Princeton professor, Ben Bernanke. As a Princeton graduate, I can say I would never trust monetary policy for the world's most powerful central bank in the hands of a Princeton economics professor. keep them in their ivy-covered towers. Now, the last phase of every speculative bubble is the one where the animal juices get the most excited. This has been the case with every major speculative bubble since the Holland tulip speculation of the 1630s, to the South Sea bubble of 1720, to the 1929 Wall Street crash. It was true as well with the 2002 through 2007 real estate bubble. In the last 2 years of the boom in selling real estate loans, banks were convinced they could resell the mortgage loans to a Wall Street financial house who would bundle it with thousands of good, better, and worse quality mortgage loans and resell them as collateralized mortgage obligation bonds. In the flush of greed, banks became increasingly reckless of the creditworthiness of the prospective homeowners. In many cases, they did not even bother to check if the person was employed. Who cares? It will be resold and securitized, and the risk of mortgage default was historically low. That was 2005. The most subprime mortgages written with adjustable rate mortgage contracts were written between 2005 and 2006, the last and most furious phase of the U.S. bubble. Now a whole new wave of mortgage defaults is about to explode onto the scene beginning January 2008. Between December 2007 and July 1, 2008, more than $690 billion in mortgages will face an interest rate jump according to the contract terms of the ARMs written 2 years before. That means market interest rates for those mortgages will explode monthly payments just as a recession drives incomes down. Hundreds of thousands of homeowners will be forced to do the last resort of any homeowner, stop monthly mortgage payments. Here's where the Ohio court decision guarantees that the next phase of the U.S. mortgage crisis will assume tsunami dimension. If the Ohio Deutsche Bank precedent holds in the appeal to the Supreme Court, millions of homes will be in default, but the banks prevented from seizing them as collateral assets to resell. Robert Shiller of Yale, the controversial and often correct author of the book Irrational Exuberance, predicting the 2001-2002 dot-com stock crash, estimates U.S. housing prices could fall as much as 50% in some areas, given how home prices have diverged relative to rents. The $690 billion worth of interest-only ARMs due for interest rate hike between now and July 2008 are by and large not subprime, but a little higher quality, but only just. There are a total of $1.4 trillion in interest-only ARMs, according to the U.S. research firm First American Loan Performance. A recent study calculates that as these ARMs face staggering higher interest costs in the next 9 months, more than $325 billion worth of loans will default, leaving 1 million property owners in technical mortgage default. But if banks are unable to reclaim the homes as assets to offset the non-performing mortgages, the U.S. banking system and a chunk of the global banking system faces a financial gridlock that will make events to date truly peanuts by comparison. We will discuss the global geopolitical implications of this in our next report, The Financial Tsunami Part 2. And that was The Financial Tsunami Part 1, Deutsche Bank's Painful Lesson by F. William Engdahl, published November 26, 2007 on oilgeopolitics.net. We'll continue now with The Financial Tsunami Part 2, subtitled The Financial Foundations of the American Century, published by F. William Engdahl, January 18, 2008. Engdahl wrote, "The ongoing and deepening global financial crisis, nominally triggered in late June 2007 by the sudden collapse of two Bear Stearns hedge funds with excessive exposure to subprime mortgages, can best be understood as an essential part of an historical process dating back to the end of the Second World War, the rise and decline of the American century. The American century, proudly proclaimed by Time Life founder and establishment insider Henry Luce in a famous 1941 Life magazine editorial, was built on the preeminent role of New York banks and Wall Street investment banks, which had by then clearly replaced the city of London as the center of gravity of global finance. Luce's American century was to be built in a far more calculated manner than the British Empire it replaced. A then top-secret Council on Foreign Relations post-war planning group, the War and Peace Studies Group, led by Johns Hopkins president and geopolitical geographer Isaiah Bowman, laid out a series of studies designed to lay the foundations of their post-war world, already beginning 1939, well before German tanks had rolled into Poland. The American Empire was to be an empire indeed, but it would not make the fatal mistake of the British or other European empires before, namely to be an empire of open colonial conquest, with costly troops in permanent military occupation. Instead, the American century would be packaged and sold to the world, above all the emerging countries of Africa, Latin America, and Asia, as the guardian of liberty, democracy. It would clothe itself as the foremost advocate of the end to colonial rule, a stance which uniquely benefited the only major power without large colonies, namely the United States. The new American century world was to be led by the champion of free trade everywhere, which also uniquely befitted the strongest economy in the early post-war years, the United States. It was a brilliant, if fatally flawed, concept. As State Department planning head George F. Kennan wrote in a confidential internal memo in 1948, quote, "We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. A real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriment to our national security," close quote. The core of the War and Peace studies, which were designed for and implemented by the U.S. State Department after 1944, was to be the creation of a United Nations organization to replace the British-dominated League of Nations. A central part of the new UN organization, which would serve as the preserver of the U.S.-friendly post-war status quo, was the creation of what were originally referred to as the Bretton Woods institutions, the International Monetary Fund, and the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, or World Bank. The GATT multinational trade agreements were later added. The U.S. negotiators in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, led by U.S. Treasury Deputy Secretary Harry Dexter White, imposed a design on the IMF and World Bank, which assured the two would remain essentially instruments of an informal U.S. empire, initially based on credit, and later, after about 1973, on debt. New York and the New York Federal Reserve Bank were the heart of the new empire in 1945. The United States held the overwhelming majority of world central bank monetary gold reserves. The post-war Bretton Woods gold exchange standard uniquely benefited the role of the U.S. dollar, then and even now, world reserve currency. All IMF member country currencies were to be fixed in value to the U.S. dollar. In turn, the U.S. dollar, but only the U.S. dollar, was fixed to a preset weight of gold at $35 per ounce of gold. At this fixed rate, foreign governments and central banks could exchange dollars for gold. Bretton Woods established a system of payments based on the dollar, in which all currencies were defined in relation to the dollar. It was ingenious and uniquely favorable to the emerging financial power of New York, whose bankers actively shaped the final agreements. In those days, in stark contrast to the present, the dollar was, quote, as good as gold. The U.S. currency was effectively the world currency, the standard to which every other currency was pegged. As the world's key currency, most international transactions were denominated in dollars. Maintaining the role of the U.S. dollar as world reserve currency has been the foremost pillar of the American century since 1945, related to, but more strategic, even than U.S. military superiority. How that dollar primacy has been maintained to now encompasses the history of countless post-war wars, financial warfare, debt crises, and threats of nuclear war to the present. Important to place the emergence of the asset securitization revolution in global finance, which is now impacting the world financial system in wave after wave of new shocks and dislocations, and to appreciate Alan Greenspan's substantial contribution to preserving the dominance of the dollar as world reserve well beyond the point the U.S. economy ceased being the world's most productive industrial manufacturer, a brief review of the distinct phases in post-war dollar hegemony is useful. And I'm reading from F. William Engdahl's article, The Financial Tsunami. The Golden Years of America's Century. The first phase, which we might call the post-war Golden Years, saw the U.S. emerge from the ashes of World War II as the unchallenged global economic colossus. The U.S. was the dominant world power. No one even came close. Over half of all international money transactions were financed in terms of dollar. The U.S. produced more than half the world output. The U.S. also owned about two-thirds of the official gold reserves in the world in 1940. When various European countries had reserve surpluses, they converted the surpluses into dollar reserves rather than gold because they could earn interest on dollar assets, such as U.S. Treasury bonds, and dollars could always be converted into gold at $35 per ounce whenever it became necessary. The U.S. dollar was at the center of this system. American industry, led by General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler Motors, the Big Three, were the world-class leaders. No one was even close back then. U.S. steel, machine tool manufacturer, aluminum, aircraft, and related industries all set the benchmark for global excellence well into the 1950s. Above all, the American oil giants, Mobil, Standard Oil of New Jersey, Texaco, Gulf Oil, these key companies dominated the unique energy source which was to become essential to unprecedented post-war growth rates in Europe, Japan, and the rest of the post-war world, petroleum. In this early post-war period, demand for dollars in the world to finance reconstruction was so great that the primary economic problem faced in the 1950s in Europe, Japan, South Korea, and elsewhere was dollar shortages to finance imports of needed U.S. capital equipment, its oil, its consumer products. U.S. monetary gold stocks reached a record $24.6 billion in 1949, a huge sum that was comparable today to $211 billion, as gold from abroad poured into the United States to pay the deficits in trade run up by foreign nations. New York, backed by gold reserves, was the unchallenged world banker. This process began to deteriorate after a steep post-war recession in 1957 and 58. That recession should have been the alarm bell to U.S. economic policy planners and industry that the unique period of profiting from the relative economic dislocation of a war-torn world was at its outer limits. Beginning in 1957, the U.S. economy was in need of a substantial regeneration were it to remain globally competitive. that was not to happen. By the time of the November 1967 British sterling crisis, where the British government was forced to violate IMF rules and devalue sterling by 14% to maintain their economy amid severe recession, the focus turned on the fact that President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and disastrous Vietnam War costs were causing the U.S. government to run record budget deficits. The dollar was vulnerable to a run on U.S. gold for the first time since the 1930s. To hide the extent of those deficits, the Johnson administration introduced creative accounting. For the first time, the budget director added the funds paid by working Americans into the Federal Social Security Trust Fund, a surplus that was to have been set aside to pay future retirement and related benefits for most Americans, to the consolidated general budget, a start to budget fakery by which the early years of the next century were to become huge. Johnson also began manipulation of key government economic statistics used to compute everything from unemployment to inflation to GDP. These statistical manipulations, for reasons of obvious if fateful political opportunism, were endorsed silently by every succeeding administration, the most egregious of them being the present Bush-Cheney administration. And I'm reading from The Financial Tsunami by F. William Engdahl. The 1971 dollar coup. Despite all the manipulations, by 1971, U.S. monetary gold reserves had reached a precarious low as foreign trade surplus nations, led by France, had demanded payment in hard gold from the U.S. Federal Reserve for their dollar surpluses. Reality could not be so easily manipulated as government statistics. Europe had emerged, along with Japan, as powerful, trade surplus, modern, fast-growing economies. The United States was becoming a vast rust belt of decaying, obsolescent manufacture. The spin doctors of Wall Street and select think tanks such as the Ford and Rockefeller Foundations came up with a linguistic euphemism calling it the post-industrial society, but linguistics did not change the reality. By the late 1960s, America's once booming industrial centers from Detroit to Pittsburgh to Chicago had become sprawling slums of decay, crime, and rising unemployment. Were the United States to lose its last gold reserves, the role of the dollar as unique world reserve currency, the pillar, along with U.S. military superiority, of its post-war American century imperium, would end abruptly. To avert such a calamity, in August 1971, President Nixon huddled with his closest advisors, among them a U.S. Treasury official named Paul Volcker, then Undersecretary of the Treasury for International Monetary Affairs, and a longtime associate of David Rockefeller and the Rockefeller family. The task was to come up with a solution. Volcker's solution to the massive demand to redeem U.S. dollars for gold was to be as simple as it was to prove destructive to world economic health. Nixon announced to a startled world on August 15, 1971, that from that day, the United States would no longer honor its international treaty obligations under the Bretton Woods Agreement. Nixon had suspended convertibility of the dollar into gold. The New York Fed's gold discount window was locked shut. World currencies went into a free float against an uncertain dollar, a so-called fiat currency. The dollar now was not backed by gold or even silver, but only the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, a commodity whose marketable value was beginning to be questioned. Debt becomes the vehicle. Soon, with the implicit threat of withdrawing its nuclear shield as its prime persuasion, successive U.S. administrations realized that rather than depending on its role as the world's creditor, as it had until 1971, the American century could theoretically thrive as the world's greatest debtor, so long as American finance and the dollar dominated world finance. As long as major U.S. post-war satrapies such as Japan, South Korea, or Germany were forced to depend on the U.S. security umbrella, it was relatively simple to pressure their treasuries into using their U.S. dollar trade surpluses to buy U.S. government debt. In the process, the U.S. bond or debt markets became far and away the world's largest. Wall Street primary bond dealers were replacing Pittsburgh Steel and Detroit car manufacturer as the business of America. To paraphrase a famous quip of former GM President Charles Wilson from the 1950s, the new mantra was, "What's good for Wall Street is good for America." It wasn't. The name financial industry even became commonplace, as if to designate money as the legitimate successor to production of real physical wealth in the economy. Debt, dollar debt, was to be the vehicle for a new role of New York banks, led by David Rockefeller's Chase Manhattan and Walter Wriston's Citibank. Their idea was to extend hundreds of billions of dollars in newly acquired OPEC and other petrodollars, which they, quote, persuaded Saudi and other OPEC governments to bank their new oil surplus in London or New York banks. These dollar deposits from OPEC, called by Henry Kissinger and others at the time petrodollars, went in the form of recycled loans to oil-importing and dollar-starved third-world economies. The Carter dollar confidence crisis. This second phase, the post-gold era, fueled by the manipulated 1973 oil shock and U.S. pressure on Saudi Arabia and OPEC to price oil exclusively in dollars, Kissinger's petrodollar recycling rolled along without major trouble until early 1979, when the dollar faced a major foreign sell-off during the end of the Jimmy Carter presidency. The American century faced one of its greatest challenges at that juncture. German, Japanese, even Saudi Arabian central banks began dumping U.S. Treasury holdings in what was called a loss of confidence in Carter's world leadership role. In August 1979, to restore world confidence in the dollar, President Jimmy Carter, himself a hand-picked protege of David Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission, was forced by the big New York banks, led by David Rockefeller's Chase Manhattan, to accept Paul Volcker, a protege of Rockefeller's from Chase Manhattan Bank, as new chairman of the Federal Reserve with an open mandate to do what was necessary to save the dollar as reserve currency. On taking office, Volcker bluntly announced, "The standard of living for the average American has to decline." He was Rockefeller's hand-picked choice to save the New York financial markets and the dollar at the expense of the nation's welfare. And I'm reading The Financial Tsunami by F. William Engdahl. The Volcker Shock Therapy. Volcker's shock therapy, begun in October 1979, lasted until August 1982. Interest rates shot through the roof to double digits. The U.S. and world economies were plunged into a monster recession, the worst since World War II. Within a year, the prime rate had shot up to the unheard-of level of 21.5%, compared to an average of 7.6%, for the 14 previous years, a more than threefold rise in weeks. Official U.S. unemployment peaked at 11%, while unofficially, when those who had simply given up seeking work were counted, it was far higher. The shock therapy of Volcker doubled U.S. official unemployment. The Latin American debt crisis, an ominous foretaste of U.S. today's subprime crisis, erupted as a direct result of the Volcker shock. In August 1982, Mexico announced it could no longer pay in dollars the interest rate service on its staggering debt. it as most of the third world, from Argentina to Brazil, from Nigeria to Congo, from Poland to Yugoslavia, had fallen for the New York Bank's debt trap. The trap was in borrowing what amounted to recycled OPEC petrodollars invested in the major New York and London banks, the Eurodollar banks, which lent the dollars to desperate third world borrowers, initially at floating rates tied to London LIBOR rates. LIBOR is an acronym that stands for London Interbank Origination Rates, the rate at which British banks lend to one another. Continuing, when LIBOR rose some 300% within months as a result of the Volcker shock therapy, those debtor countries were unable to continue. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, was brought in, and the greatest looting binge in world history, misnamed the Third World Debt Crisis, was on. Volcker's shock policy predictably triggered the crisis. After 7 years of relentlessly high interest rates by the Volcker Fed, sold to the gullible public as squeezing inflation out of the U.S. economy, by 1986, the internal state of the U.S. economy was horrendous. Much of America came to resemble a third world country, with its growing slums, double-digit unemployment, and growing crime and drug addiction problems. A Federal Reserve study showed that 55% of all American families were net debtors. Federal budget deficits were running at then unheard-of levels of more than $200 billion annually. In reality, Volcker, a personal protege of David Rockefeller from Rockefeller's Chase Manhattan Bank, had been sent to Washington to do one thing, to save the dollar from a free-fall collapse that threatened the role of the U.S. dollar as global reserve currency. The dollar reserve currency role was the hidden key to American financial power. By letting U.S. interest rates go through the roof, foreign investors flooded in to reap the gains by buying U.S. bonds. Bonds were and are the heart of the financial system. Volcker's shock therapy for the economy meant soaring profits for the New York financial community. Volcker succeeded only too well in his mission. The dollar rose to all-time highs against the currencies of Germany, Japan, Canada, and other countries from 1979 through the end of 1985. The overvalued U.S. dollar made U.S. manufactured exports prohibitively expensive on world markets and led to a dramatic decline in U.S. industrial exports. Already high interest rates from the Volcker Fed since October 1979 led to a major decline in domestic construction, the ultimate ruin of the U.S. automobile industry, and with it, steel, as American manufacturers moved to outsource production offshore, where the cost advantages were greater. Referring to Paul Volcker and his free market backers inside the Reagan White House, Republican Robert O. Anderson, then chairman of Atlantic Richfield Oil Company, complained, "They've done more to dismantle American industry than any other group in history, yet they go around saying everything is great. It's like the Wizard of Oz." Close quote. By early 1987, the nation's traditional mortgage banks, the savings and loan banks, were in a liquidity crisis that was ultimately to cost U.S. taxpayers hundreds of billions in government bailouts. The Congress GAO watchdog agency declared that the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, the guarantor against SNL bank panic, was insolvent. Yet under pressure from the SNLs, huge bank losses were allowed to build as insolvent institutions were allowed to remain open and grow, allowing ever-increasing losses to accumulate. The ultimate cost of the 1980s SNL debacle came to more than $160 billion. Some calculated real cost to the economy ran as high as $900 billion. Between 1986 and 1991, the number of new homes constructed dropped from 1.8 to 1 million, the lowest rate since World War II. And I'm reading from The Financial Tsunami by F. William Engdahl, an article published on oilgeopolitics.net. America's second revolution, the eyes on the prize. Federal Reserve monetary policy has been typically misrepresented as a series of ad hoc, pragmatic responses to recurring crises in post-war banking and finance. The reality is that it has faithfully followed a coherent, hidden thread of policy that was first laid out in 1973 by the spokesman then for America's most powerful establishment family. The policy was outlined in a little-noted book titled, ominously enough, The Second American Revolution. It was written by John D. Rockefeller III, scion of the powerful Standard Oil and Chase Manhattan Bank empire, along with his three brothers, David, Nelson, and Lawrence, architect of the world arrangement after 1945, known as the American Century. In his book, Rockefeller declared the establishment's determination to roll back concessions grudgingly granted by the wealthy and powerful during the Great Depression. Rockefeller issued the call in 1973, long before Jimmy Carter or Margaret Thatcher came to office to implement it. He called for a deliberate, consistent, long-term policy to decentralize and privatize many government functions, to diffuse power throughout the society, close quote. The latter was a witting deception, as his intent was not to diffuse power, but just the opposite, to concentrate that economic and banking power into the hands of a tight-knit elite. Privatization of essential and socially useful government functions that had been established often with great social agitation and political pressure during the difficult crises of the 1930s was the Rockefeller agenda. In brief, it was the removal of Depression-era government regulations on all aspects of economic and social life in America. Above all, deregulation of Wall Street and financial markets was the goal, along with a radical reduction in the equalizing of wealth, as seen by Rockefeller and friends, inherent in such programs as Social Security. The George W. Bush tax cuts for the wealthy were just a continuation of the three-decade agenda of the powerful establishment circles. Hard as it may be to believe, all major U.S. policy from 1970s through the misnamed subprime crisis today has a connecting, continuous thread. Key Fed and Treasury and other U.S. policymakers always had their eyes on the prize. The prize was untold financial gains to be won through a rollback of major concessions to the working blue-collar and middle-income Americans, concessions granted during the Great Depression by powerful establishment circles led by the Rockefeller and Morgan banking groups to forestall a more radical revolt. Social Security was one target for rollback. Financial deregulation and, above all, repeal of the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act was another. Here, a well-connected Wall Street banker named Alan Greenspan was to play the decisive role on behalf of the financial deregulation agenda in his tenure as Federal Reserve Chairman, lasting from 1987 to 2006. Securitization of subprime or junk mortgages was to have been his crowning legacy. As it looks at this writing, it certainly will be, though perhaps not as he and others in Wall Street intended. It will be more likely a crown of disgrace. And that was the end of part two of The Financial Tsunami. Engdahl promises that part three will deal with the Greenspan creation of the securitization revolution and its subsequent demise. I wish it were here today for me to read it to you, but it is not. So keep a lookout on his website, Engdahl, E-N-G-D-A-H-L dot oilgeopolitics.net. I think if you can just remember oilgeopolitics, all run together, .net, you will find him. Also his book, Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, published in November 2007. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.